So what has God got to do with sex? Sex, after all, is naughty and dirty and lots of fun, and that's a far cry from God and the Bible, isn't it? I mean, isn't God a sort of cosmic killjoy, and, you know, whose only words are just don't do it? And those of, you know, those people who call themselves Christians, aren't they the most anti-sex, boring, bigoted, puritanical homophobes ever? And the Bible, I mean, isn't the Bible just a set of rules? I mean, and it's so outdated for today. I mean, just that book, what do you call it, Leviticus? I mean, you know, those rules. What has it got to do for us today? These are the questions that I have been asked. And if you as a Christian are going to talk about sexuality, this is the kind of comments you're going to be asked. This morning I spent an hour with one of my very best friends who's an atheist, homosexual, sexual health physician. And these are the things we were talking about. And these are the questions you're going to be asked. And for goodness sake, I call myself a sexologist. Firstly, what is a sexologist? A sexologist is somebody who studies about sex, reads about sex, writes about sex, talks about sex, does sex therapy, and has sex in the little time left over. But anyway, I call myself a sexologist. And I guess the question is, how can you be a sexologist and be a Christian? And I mean, it's just amazing. The answer to all these questions is really the same. Sex, sexologists research sex, everybody has sex, but ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters in Christ, we have a personal relationship with the creator of sex. And that is the message that we have for the world. And that is what I'm hoping you will take away today. At the end of today's talk, that you will catch a little of my passion for sex and good, healthy sexuality for all ages, and my passion for the wonderful creator of sex, our God and creator. Now, this is new for me, so I'm going to see whether I'll get it done. Yes, it works. Okay, sex in all its sensual beauty is an essential part of God's plan. And I'm just going to go fairly briefly on the theology, because I know you had a whole series of lectures, sermons, messages. I'm an academic, you can see here that. You had a whole series of talks on relationships, so you probably dealt with this. But you know, when Jesus was asked about divorce, he went right back to creation and he talked about created in the image of God, male and female, very clearly gendered. Now, I'm not going to be talking much about gender today, very briefly in the talk, but if you want to ask any questions about gender and any issues of gender, I do another talk called Male, Female, and All Things in Between. But if you have any questions, I'm most happy to take them. My training at postgraduate level in Hawaii was with one of the world's best known professors in gender, so I can pretty much answer most questions on the area. So getting back to what Jesus said, male and female, very clearly male and female. And then he says that a man will leave and be united, and after the uniting will be the one flesh, naked and no shame. So we'll tease these things out as we move through. Now, when God made Adam and Eve, as you well realize, they were perfect. So Adam was this absolute perfect man, you know, like six-pack to die for, or if you call it shredded abs or whatever young people call it today, whatever it was perfect. Like he had to run around the Garden of Eden looking for lots of fig leaves. And Eve was just this perfect body, no boob job, no Botox, you know, that perfect. So, and in that uniting, everything about their maleness and femaleness was perfect. They had no problems with being a male or a female. Femininity, masculinity were perfect in the Garden of Eden. But of course, this oneness and goodness of sex was destroyed when we reject our God and we turn away. And then, as the Apostle Paul says, we now need our sexuality redeemed. And, you know, we've got lots of passages, but I love this particular passage from the Apostle Paul, because when we look at that passage, it says we are members of the body of Christ, but then he talks about your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit whom you received. You are not your own. You're bought at a price. Honor God with your body. And that embodiment created male and female, and that honoring God with our bodies as redeemed Christians, as redeemed men and women, that is so important, and that so exemplifies and carries the message of good sexuality and good relationships. The fact that we are embodied, created in the image of God, but embodied male and female. So today we will be looking at three things. I'd like to look at, explore some sexological research on desire, libido, horny, sex drive, frisky, call it whatever you will, and falling in love and long-term bonding. Have a quick look at, a critical look at society and what society says about it, and then look at God's plan. Look at the lens of God's plan. Let's start with sexual desire, always a good place to start. Sexual desire, the science first, is a testosterone-fueled drive deep in, for you scientists, the limbic system of our brain, that sort of deep emotional part of our brain. It's powered by this whole cocktail of chemicals. It is a non-specific, I want sex hunger. It's a hunger. It's an appetite. It's non-specific. You can feed it by anything, by fantasy, by solo sex, by couple sex. So it's a non-specific hunger. That's what the chemistry, that's what it is. Now, just two quick points on this desire. And that is, especially for those of you who are parents, and basically anyone in the church dealing with young people, to understand something about the developing teen brain or the young brain. The young brain is a work in progress. What do I mean about this? There was a time when we went to medical school, which was the time of the dinosaurs, and we thought that, you know, the brain just grew till about 10, and then that's it. It just stayed that way after that. Now we know that brains are changeable. The word we say is neuroplastic. Actually through life, but the main work happens in that teenage, at puberty, when kids kick into puberty. What I call the volcano brain begins to erupt. What is that? It is the emotional and sexual part of the brain, deep there. So it begins erupting. Put on that the fact that puberty ages are dropping. So puberty dropping, the age dropping, and this volcano brain of emotion starts erupting. You all know, if you have had a teen around, you know, I'm in that emotional state. That's fine. But the part of the brain that is involved with decision making and control, the sort of frontal parietal, the lobes here, they develop much slower. They don't mature till about the mid-20s. So can you see that disjunct between the emotional volcano and what I tell young people is the wet rag? So it's like a volcano with a wet rag trying to hold it down. So remember when you have a teenager around, or if you are a teenager now, and you're thinking, you're out of control. Guess what? You are out of control when you are in that age, because your control brain is only just developing, but developing slowly. It's interesting. Why did God do that? I've got my own theory. I'm waiting to ask God. Not that it'll matter when I get there, but anyway. I think God had a whole pattern in it. He said, look, I'm not going to give these kids a full control, because I'm going to give them an external control system. What do you think he called the external control system? Parents. I love it when I say this in schools. And I say, what do you think God called the external control system? And everyone goes, parents. You know? So yeah, parents and youth workers and ministers and guess what? Aunties and uncles in the church. You all are a form of external control to the young people you come in touch with. That is so important. Because, and why is it so important? So there's a volcano, there's a slowly developing control system, and everything that goes into the brain at that time is going to affect how the brain develops. I mean, not just talking sex, everything. So what videos are the kids watching? What television shows are they watching? What kind of internet information is getting into their brain? This will influence their sexual attitudes and behavior. We know that now. So all of you who are over 24 are now sitting here going, that's fine, I'm over 24, my brain's fine. Well, I've got news for you. We also know that the adult brains stay plastic. So what you are feeding your brain even now is continuing to rewire your brain. So if you are watching pornography, you are rewiring, you are wiring your desire circuits. Of course, that's a huge area, and I'll touch on that a little bit later. So what turns you on, talking about desire, is affected a lot by what's been put in there during your developing age. We call that building a script. But even now, at whatever age you are, what you put into your brain will affect the wiring of your brain. So what is the world view of desire? This is really important for all of us, but particularly for younger people to understand. Because the world tells young people and tells all of us that sexual desire, actually desire of any type, is a need to be fed. It is natural. So the narcissistic, individualistic society we live in says repressing your desires is unhealthy. You must have sex. Young people are told this all the time. If you don't have sex, you are abnormal. You are less, you're not healthy. You're not human. You have free and you have rights. Anybody who tells you you shouldn't be having sex is actually, you know, taking away your human rights, not just your sexual rights. This is the world's view. This is what our young people are going to hear. You see, when sex and desire is a need, purity is self-starvation. And that is the message our young people and all of us hear in the world today. So when you live by a pleasure paradigm of self-gratification, then why would you control yourself? Isn't it fascinating? We tell people that if you eat too much and you get really fat, we are going to put you on the Biggest Loser show and laugh at you. And if you smoke, we keep you out of our restaurants. And, you know, if you don't do something else, you know, you're laughed at. If you have too much, you can't control yourself. But when it comes to sex, self-control, why? Why self-control? And our whole society talks about it. Bonk longer, we are told. This, I haven't seen these signs much now. But, you know, it says, you want something, we can give it to you. You want anything. You want bigger genitals. You want some kind of better looking genitals. We can do the surgery. We can give you the tablets. We can, although I must say the most arousing there for me is the petrol price. But anyway, so, I think different things arouse different people. However, the ultimate idolatry, and I won't go into this in detail, but again, if anyone wants to ask me about anything in pornography during the question and answer time, please do, because I do talks on porn and purity. And I know you've had some talks, I think, in your relationship, especially for the men. But today we know the science that porn use rewires the brain. It even changes your brain structure. This is non-Christian secular science telling us this, right? Today, porn is a $10 billion, $100 billion industry, $100 billion industry. The average age of first porn exposure is 11 to 12 years in Australia. Almost every young boy has seen, been exposed to pornography because of the mobile phones and kids bringing it to primary school. So we need to get our children prepared. It's a primary sex educator of especially our young boys. I did focus groups when writing the teen sex book, and boys would just tell me, how would we know what girls like if we don't watch porn? This is what boys said themselves. Girls would tell me, all our boyfriends watch porn. They ask us to groan like porn stars. This is what we are hearing from our young people today. It is a prime relationship breaker. I work as a sex therapist under duress, only when like I get couples or somebody contacts me and says, I'm a Christian, we are Christians, we'd like to see you. But all, I would say about 80% of the couples I see with problems will have a porn current or past exposure problem. And that would be a very significant part of the concern. This is what we are seeing. And of course, it's now turning to sexual compulsion and addiction. It is a dangerous to me. This is why I call it the ultimate idolatry. I really feel this is the thing that we are fighting, especially with our young people. But God has a plan. You see, in God's plan for sexual desire, sexual desire is a gift. When I'm speaking to young people, I tell them, if not for sexual desire, you won't be here. Because your parents wouldn't have had sex. And I guess that holds for you too. I mean, you wouldn't be here, right, if your parents didn't have sex. And I love it when I talk to young people. I say, if you're a single child, your parents had sex at least once. If you have siblings, they at least had sex that many times. When I was in Katoomba, I said, guess what your parents are doing now that they've sent you to camp. But anyway, the point is that the I want of sexual desire, remember what I said, sexual desire, I want sex. It is good. It's powerful. I mean, three times in the Song of Songs, we hear, you know, daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken love till the right time, till it so desires. So it is powerful and purposeful. We read it in Genesis, you know, when created, they were told, be fruitful and multiply. When God said fruitful and multiply, you know, he didn't mean, you know, plant apple trees and do mathematics. He basically said, get out there and have sex. Now, isn't it nice that our God, wonderful, gracious God that he is, said, get out there, have sex. And by the way, it's going to be the most fun you ever have in following my command. I mean, he could have made it really boring, like, you know, fill in a form in triplicate and send it to the Department of Baby Making. But no. Our good God said, it's going to be the greatest fun you ever have in your life following my command. I mean, you know, that's a great God. But he also said, look, I want it in the right situation, in the right context. And therefore, I will give you self-control. However young you are, even with just a wet rag, self-control, it's gift of the Spirit, work on it. This is something we need to be very, very sure that we teach our young people, that they are not just balls of hormones, that just because they have a desire, we don't have to live it. The world says you desire, it's a need, it's a right, take it. We say it's a gift, it's a blessing, among many blessings, enjoy it as God's gift. But God's gift is fragile, just like any good gift, it's fragile. And God gives you the right context, the right place to use it in. And so sexual desire, this wonderful desire that God has given us, powerful, purposeful. Let's fall in love. Okay, love is an amazing thing. I mean, you know, just look at the person, you know, those of you who are in couples, just, you know, remember the time you had one look. You know, you were sitting in that sermon on Ezekiel, or Ezekiel has sex in it. I can't find a Bible, any Bible book that doesn't have sex. So, you know, something that didn't have sex. But suddenly you looked across church, there she was, or there he was, and you had that heart palpitating, pupil dilating moment. You know, you wanted him in your life, you wanted her in your bed, you wanted him, you know, forever. It's chemistry, ladies and gentlemen. You have a dopamine, which is a wonderful chemical. It sprays all over your brain when you fall in love. I love the word. It makes you so dopey, this dopamine. And, you know, it just sprayed and it just makes you motivate. It motivates you to pursue one person. Can you see what's happening? All that energy of desire is now focused on one person. And so you want that one person. Serotonin level goes down. It's the same chemical that goes down in obsessive compulsive behavior. The dopamine, serotonin changes are the same if you take a cocaine hit. So love is an obsession, love is an addiction. Falling in love is a chemical addiction, an obsession, a high stress activity. And to add to all that, it is also, when you're in love, your fear and judgment centers are suppressed. Do you remember the time when somebody was in love with someone and you thought, what does she see in him? You know, she doesn't, because the judgment centers are suppressed. And the point here is, when you talk to young people need to understand this, that when you fall in love, it's really a time of like craziness and you need help. And I talk to young people, I say, look, you need help when you're in love because you're crazy and you need to recognize that. And as a church, we need to recognize this, because you see, you're crazy at that time and you can do crazy things. But the world will say that if you feel this love, you must act on it. So love becomes lust. So I love someone, oh, so I must fulfill myself. I must have this person. I must have sex with this person. So it's translated as, I love you, really means I love myself and I must gratify myself. So if you're young, if you're a young person, it means I must have sex. I must have sex of some sort. Even if I don't have intercourse, I must have, you know, oral sex or some form of intimate sexual activity. Sex. Love equals lust. Many people have lost that ability to even tease it out. And it's taken for granted that if I love you, I must have your body. I must be sexually intimate with you. So that's young people. What about marrieds? How often have we heard someone who says, I'm not in love with my wife or my husband anymore. I must move away. I've got this love for someone else. I must be fulfilled. I must seek my happiness. We are so buying into the world, ladies and gentlemen, if we dare to think that way, because this is what the world will tell us, that it is about self, it's about me, it's about myself, and that is all that really matters, that it is equal to lust. You see, research tells us, and for anyone who really wants to read more about that, Kevin Andrews, yes, Sir Kevin Andrews in Canberra, has written a book called Maybe I Do, which draws really good Australian statistics on marriage. And in that, he draws in the research called what we call the cohabitation effect. And that is that couples who cohabit or live together and get married, their marriages are actually less successful. There are higher divorce rates than couples who don't sleep together before marriage. We call this sliding into marriage versus actually making a decision and a commitment, because you've lived together and then you sort of slid into marriage. And then you're going like, what's happening here? I'm not in love with you. And so you can slide out. So there is a cohabitation effect, we call it. And so, you know, research shows us that it isn't working. And yet, this is the most recent statistics from Australia, and this was only released about 2 weeks, La Trobe University. They talked to about 3,000 young teens, years 10 to 12, and they said 69% are sexually active, 40% have had oral sex, 23% of year 10, about one-third of year 11 and half of year 12 have had sexual intercourse. The scary statistic there is about a quarter of the girls and a fifth of the boys said that they had experienced unwanted sex. This is alcohol-fueled, drug-fueled, or coercion. This is a sad statistic there. Now, when I show this to you, and especially to young people, and I would really strongly recommend you look at it with this different lens too. The young people are told everybody's doing it. Even 69% is not everybody. 30% are not having any form of sexual activity. That's more than there are Christians in that age group. So guess what? Non-Christians are not having sex. Wow, that's something. So why not young people? Why not challenge our young people to be the countercultural ones who are not having sex? Even look at the ones with sexual intercourse. Even year 12, only 50% are having sexual intercourse. Only 50% are not having sexual intercourse. That doesn't make it everybody is having sex. Take that message to your young people, because this is a myth. On the other hand, those who are having sex, the rates of sexually transmitted infections are going up. The green line, we're not very clear there, but the green line is 15 to 19 year olds. Chlamydia. Chlamydia, for those who may not know, is a sexually transmitted infection, particularly dangerous because you don't see much symptoms. In fact, for girls, you don't have any symptoms usually, but it leads to infertility. Talking to some of my friends in the sexual health physicians, they think that very soon we are going to have an epidemic of infertility, women who can't have babies because of these high rates of chlamydia. And chlamydia, you know, we're talking condoms, but obviously they're not using condoms if the sexually transmitted disease rates are going up. 1 in 20 teenagers, sexual health physicians say, have chlamydia. That's a fair number. And they're seeing a high rate of chlamydia in children as young as 12 years of age. This is Australia statistics I'm talking about. Well, what's God got to do with romantic love? You know, ladies and gentlemen, when we talk about romance and love, we must remember that it is part of God's inherent good plan. Let's talk chemistry. Brain. Desire, I want sex. Falling in love, focusing all that on one person. Gee, doesn't that sound a lot like one flesh? Isn't that amazing? God gives us a pattern in the Bible. And then he says, oh, by the way, I think I'll create the brain to go with my word. I didn't think it came together, but whatever. Anyway, our brain neurochemistry of falling in love is so beautifully designed to focus the energy of desire towards one person. In God's word, that is for the covenant commitment of marriage. See, if we don't, and when kids and young people and older people don't understand that, but they think that just falling in love and that's all that matters. We confuse our brain. We talk to girls who have sex early, have multiple partners. They so regret it. This is all empirical studies done. You know, it is. We just can't see how the emotion of I love you in God's word is that other focus, sacrificial action. You know, when we counsel couples, we tell them when you're making love, when you're together, think, what can I do to make you happy? So when we're talking sex therapy, we say, think, what can I do to give you the best experience? Not what can I do to get myself the biggest orgasm, but rather what can I do for you? And to me, that is Ephesians 5 stuff, you know, or Corinthians chapter 7, I think, where your body belongs to the husband and his body belongs to you. I mean, it's basic Bible when we do sex therapy. We are telling each other, look to the other, and that way you will find yourself looking after yourself. That is just amazing. And it just goes back to the one flesh naked, no shame. See, I love naked and no shame because, you see, if you're naked and no shame, and do this when we talk to young people, do this in pre-marriage preparation, naked and no shame, you can be one of two things. One, you can be naked and just so perfect that you have no shame. I mean, you're just so perfect. You're just so perfect that you can stand here, take everything off, and you're just so perfect that you have no shame. But that is kind of unlikely. Definitely not likely when you're 66 and 40 years married. But the other thing is, you can be naked and no shame because you totally entrust yourself to your partner. And you know, isn't that amazing? Because that is what a Christian partnership, a marriage is. And this is when you're engaged and you're married, that is so important. Because it is about that entrusting your body and your soul, your whole being to another person in a way. And I tell young people, when you entrust yourself to a person, you must be sure that that person won't put up a note, some comment on Facebook tomorrow about what happened. You know, it happens. There are sites, Facebook sites, where you can go and put a rating of your latest sexual experience, if necessary, with a photograph. These are rating sites. So these happen with teenagers today in their cyber world. And we need to be very, very careful that we tell each other, and especially our young people, this, that you entrust yourself to the person who will look after you and honor you. This is so important for dating couples. Young people, the question young people often ask me is, how far is too far? Nothing annoys me more than that question, because that is the wrong question. The question I tell young people you should be asking each other is, how can I honor you as sister or brother? And in that honoring will come the how far. Because you are my sister or my brother, and you may not be my wife or husband, but you will be that to someone else. And it is very important we teach our young people that. So, long-term bonding. You know what? That chemistry, the palpitations, the pupil dilatation. Any of you who married more than 2 years here know that, you know, it's only sometimes that your heart goes pitter-patter when your partner walks in. You know, after 40 years of marriage, if I palpitate every time Vasantha walks in, I'll have to be reaching for my hypertensive medication twice a day. It doesn't happen, right? So what happens? Do you fall out of love? You know what happens? We've got a chemistry for that too. We move from the passionate love to a mechanism for what we call passional love. What happens there? Every time you are sexually intimate with someone, the chemical oxytocin, which interestingly is the same chemical that goes up when a mother suckles the baby and bonds the mother to the baby, when a couple are sexually intimate, the levels go up. When you have sex, as in intercourse, it goes up higher. If you have an orgasm, it brings the steeple down. No, I don't think you have a steeple, but anyway, it brings the steeple down. That is what happens. Every time you bond, every time you are intimate with someone sexually, you bond with oxytocin. So therefore, there is really nothing called casual sex. There is never casual sex. Talk about this to your young people. When you are intimate with someone, you form a little super glue bond. When you pull yourself away, you rip yourself. You leave a bit of yourself. You go join another one, and then every time you leave a bit of yourself with that person. Finally, you want to get married, you want to settle down, you're all out of super glue. And we are seeing people who are commitment phobes, who are confused. It's so important for us to tell our young people this, that casual sex isn't working. You know, young people tell me, oh, but I have sex and, you know, I'm fine. I just have a good orgasm and I move on. And I say, gee, that sounds a lot like what my dog says, you know, because animals are in heat. So they're in heat. They sniff the bitch, she's ready, they have sex, and then done and dusted, they move on. So, if we can reduce a precious act which was meant to bond us together as man and wife, we can reduce it to an animal act. And yet, there is something that deeply disturbs man and woman when they reduce it to that animal act. It does. So that in the long term, you find people who have had multiple casual encounters are very confused. Very confused. We see them in the therapy rooms. The psychiatrists see them with depression and all the problems. We see the girls with self-harm. I talk to the counselors in girls' school. The prime problem they see is girls coming in with self-harm. This is our culture today, the rates of hospitalization for self-harm in girls and boys is rising. There is confusion. We need to be able to speak clearly to the world, especially about long-term covenant relationships, because the worldview is just crazy. This is a signboard that used to be up close to the airport. Ashley Madison, they said, is a site, you know, for married affairs. Infidelity, we are told, is good for you. A little bit of adventure is good for you. They advertise as, we are the most famous website for discreet encounters between married individuals. We have an affair guarantee package. Money back if you don't get a good affair. You know, this is the world. But, you know, at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, I think it was last year, U.S. sex columnist Dan Savage suggested that non-monogamy could actually be a good thing. He said, you know, free from the confines of traditional Christian heteronormatic definitions of love and commitment, Savage has been able to bring a rationalist, amusing and libertarian perspective to the rigid U.S. media. He argues that it's good for our long-term health of our marriages to be monogamish rather than monogamous. This is the world that our children are growing up in. We may think that we have sort of survived it, but this is the world of our youth. Further, love, we are told, is what matters. Who cares about gender? My dear brothers and sisters in Christ, we are going to, this is not going away. The same-sex marriage debate, the equality of marriage debate, as it is called, is not going away. And we need to be a voice. Just an argument this morning with my dear friend who's, but this is the reality. And we will not be heard. We will be considered bigoted and homophobic. But in actual fact, if there is one group of people who are not homophobic, it is the Church of Christ. Because we love. And we need to be very clear about this. And again, if you want any questions, I'm happy to talk about it. But just talking about marriage, you know, we are aware of the gender issue. But, and you know, the moment we talk about anything else, people say, oh, the slippery slope. But guess what? Polyamory is a state where there are three or four, like three men, two women, three men, whatever. A few people live together in a committed relationship. And there, one of their spokespersons said, and this is straight out of the newspaper, we polyamorists are grateful to our lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender brothers and sisters for blazing the marriage equality trail. Genetic sexual attraction. This is a condition where, because a father and a daughter or brother and sister have been separated when they're young and then they meet later and they love each other. It's meant to be. They're siblings or they're parent and child. But that love is interpreted as sexual love. And so it's genetic sexual attraction. And the genetic sexual attraction, there's a website. They too would say, why can't we get married then? See, the slippery slope actually is real. And when it comes to marriage itself, people get married. This is why cohabitation, we think, doesn't work when they get married after cohabiting, because it's about me. It's about self-gratification. And when you no longer satisfy me, then I move on to find someone else who meets my needs, my soulmate. And this is the worldview. Of course, God's view of marriage, we are pretty certain of this, we've studied about this, but marriage, as we know, is an institution of two fallen and sinful people who are trying to live together. I mean, like, you know, it's hard. You know, hard is to get on with your family and you were born in the same family. Imagine living together with somebody and trying to learn to love them when they are like somebody completely different. That's why the chapter in our couple sex book we call Spiced Up Sanctification. We call marriage Spiced Up Sanctification because I believe when God thought, what's the best workshop for sanctification? He went, marriage. That'll build their holiness. You know, it's got to be exclusive. They can't look at other people. Well, they might have a quick look, but then go, no, that's not mine. You know, get my head back to my space. And, you know, it's got to be other focused. So you got to be sacrificial. You got to forgive, for goodness sake. And you got to stay together. Even when the naked no shame is like really, you know, when you're tight and taut, it's okay. But when you get to our age, things migrate to Melbourne. And you got to, even at that stage, be, you know, in this wonderful, loving relationship. That is what marriage is. And you know, there's beautiful complementarity of male and female roles. And again, we don't have time to be going into the details, but if we look at the sexual responses of male and female, you find this beautiful complementarity. And I can't say that and not tell you a little bit about it because you're thinking, what is it? Males are generally made to be quickly aroused. You know, there's, you walk in, wives, you walk in, you haven't even reached for your top button and his barometer up ready to go. So, you know, men are generally quickly aroused, have an erection, have an orgasm, and then like done and dusted. Generally, they're that way. Generally, there are some who are different. Women are like the slow burner versus the microwave. If men are the microwave, women are like the crock pot or the slow burner. So many women don't start sexual activity like swinging from the chandelier, but when they are with the spouse and they're being romanced, then they get sexually aroused, then they feel desire, then their body responds. So beautiful complementarity. I have this thing that God told men, you know, you get to lead in the spiritual life and the Bible reading. Guess what, guys? You get to lead in the bedroom also. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, that's a beautiful complementarity. So I love that. I love the way the Christian marriage model so works in the world. If we can only get the message out there. You know, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who are married, those of you who are planning to be married, a Christian couple, you are a walking, talking, evangelistic tool to the world. Trust me, I work with a lot of non-Christians. I had a PhD student, a Hindu boy, who was going back to India to get married, and he used to come home a lot and spend a lot of time with us because he was a single boy doing his PhD. And when he was going home to marry, to get married, arranged marriage, he came and asked me to bless him. You know, it's very traditional in the sort of subcontinent culture. He asked me to bless him, and he said, Patricia, if I have a marriage like Vasantha and you, that's all I ask for. And, you know, I used to tell him, I prayed for him. And, you know, it's just that you need, your marriage will reflect Christ and the church. It will. You may not consciously be doing it. That is what will draw people. So, what does this sort of living with sexual integrity, God's, if you're single, I'll speak to singles here for a moment. We remember, created in the image of God, Trinity means we are created for relationships. Non-sexual intimate friendships of both sexes are good and fulfilling. Jonathan and David, good fulfilling relationship. Relational satisfaction is far more satisfying than any orgasm. Orgasms are quick, short. Relational satisfaction is for life. So, non-sexual intimacy is important. And for singles, we need to remember that. For couples, engaged, dating, purity is other honoring and godly. In our book, we call the period of engagement training for trustworthiness, because that's what you're doing when you're engaged. Are you training each other? Are you learning together to be trustworthy? Are you learning self-control? Because, you know, you may, learning self-control is really important in sex. Because when you get married, and I'm speaking to married couples here, you know, tell me, how much of your married life do you actually spend making love? 50%? 25%, 10%, right? So there will be times when you want sex and your partner doesn't, or the partner's sick or gone away. And so self-control is really important, I tell couples during engagement. You better learn it now, because you're going to need a lot of it once you get married. And then when you're married, it's love in action. You see, loving is one thing. But you know what science tells us? That when you act loving, do loving things, your dopamine levels go up. So you bring back that initial loving feeling by being loving, by doing loving things. And that's important. So it's love in action. You know, it's easy to love your husband or wife on the wedding day. Come on. You know, you're the husband. You look back at her. She's an angel. And look, every man in the church thinks she looks an angel. But, you know, 20 years down the line, after she's had a couple of babies with stretch marks, she's still your angel. That's the beauty of a Christian marriage. That's the beauty of being together in that naked and no shame. The ability to say, "Oh, look at that wrinkle where it is today." And, you know, because gravity takes its toll and you still love. I tell young people, so I wish for you is that in 20 years' time, you're with somebody who say, "I love you just the way you are today." Not, you know, you see the person on that wedding day person today and you love them the way they are today. So loving sometimes even the unlovable. And as you get older, it's important to remember that intimacy is actually more important than intercourse. See, we begin to, for some reason, we think that every time we are intimate, we have to have intercourse when we are married. And I tell people, when I see couples, you know, it's like, okay, intimacy, you know, you have a whole body. I tell couples, you know, just take all your clothes off, stand in front of a full-length mirror. Now tell me what proportion of your body is actually genital. A lot of full-length mirrors tonight going, you know, is being brushed up. But the point is that you have a lot of body that is not genital. Enjoy it. I mean, intercourse is only a part of it. Enjoy the whole body intimacy. So as we get older, sometimes you might have some surgery or something, and, you know, it just might happen that you can't have sexual intercourse. But still, intimacy is hugely important. So, pulling everything together, whether you're single, married, parenting, everything really is a process of sanctification. We can't hide from it. Sex is an important part of our life, and children today, we can't hide our kids, we can't sort of not talk to them. Today we tell people you've got to start talking to your kids about sex when they're 5 and 6 years old. Because by the time they're 7 and 8 and in primary school, somebody's going to be showing them pornography, usually on a mobile phone. Talk to your kids. Tell them to come to you. Train them to come to you when anything uncomfortable happens. Today, ABC Radio, and I went to the primary article there, talking about rising incidents of primary school children abusing each other, sexually abusing each other. This is the reality of today's world. Talk to your children. It's not a nice world out there. But we have a message. We shouldn't hide it. We have a message that God gave us, a good message for good sex. That's part of His message. And therefore, that we can bravely get out there and talk about it. There's nothing to be ashamed about it. Please get out there and talk to your children. You know, in church, all of you at some level will have some influence on young people. So fearlessly talk to the young people. And remember that, you know, you will meet young people and older people who will have made some silly decisions, have done crazy things in their sex life at some level. And just remember that, you know, when it comes to your children, God forgives, God guides, God redeems. And if it's your children, so can you. You know, when the Apostle Paul, having listed all these sexual sins, he said, so were some of you, but you are washed, you are sanctified. And you know, there may be even someone here who's feeling uncomfortable, convicted by something we talked about. That is okay. You know, you need to talk to your minister, talk to an older person, and just work through it. Because sexuality in the world today is it's a very powerful, but it's also a very, and I'm using the word carefully, it's become a very evil tool. And we as God's people need to be clear about what we believe and our message, and then fearlessly speak it to the world. Okay, so we will take a short break and then come back with questions. So Bruce, we can text questions or take it from the floor, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, how long are you going to give them?
Let's have 10, 15 minutes for a short break. There's tea and coffee out there, toilets out the doors to the left. Let me just mention now, I'm very thankful that Patricia has allowed us to record tonight and to put it online as well, so you can send a link to your friends if you like, very subtly. We'll have a question time later, and they'll be anonymous questions if they're texted, obviously. If you call them out, we know who you are. And I'll repeat the questions for the recording, so they'll be available as well. So feel free to text any time over the next 10 minutes or so. Please go and grab a drink, something to eat, and we'll be back in 10.
And as I said, I mean, if there's some other questions in the whole area of sexuality you want to ask, ask. That's nothing that ever shocks me. Might shock Bruce, but not shock me.